Shrink Wrap Radio number 316, Exploring Neuropsychoanalysis with Mark Solms, PhD.
It's Shrink Wrap Radio. All the psychology you need to know and just enough to make it dangerous. It's all in your head. And now here's your host, Dr. Dave.
My guest today is Professor Mark Solms, who's located in South Africa, and we'll be discussing his work on neuropsychoanalysis. Mark Solms, PhD, is best known for his discovery of the four brain mechanisms of dreaming and his pioneering use of psychoanalytic methods and theories in contemporary neuroscience. Born in Lüderitz in 1961, he was educated at Pretoria Boys School and the University of Witwatersrand, Johannesburg, South Africa. He moved to London in 1988, where he worked at the Royal London Hospital in the Department of Neurosurgery, while he trained as an analyst at the Institute of Psychoanalysis. He returned to South Africa in 2002, where he now holds a professorship in neuropsychology at the University of Cape Town. Mark Solms is president of the South African Psychoanalytic Association, a member of the British Psychoanalytical Society, and an honorary member of the New York Psychoanalytic Society. His honors include the George Sarton Medal for contributions to the history and philosophy of science, the International Psychiatrist Award for contributions to American psychiatry from the American Psychiatric Association in 2001, and the Sigourney Prize for contributions to psychoanalysis. He's published more than 250 chapters and articles in both neuroscientific and psychoanalytic journals, and 5 books, including The Neuropsychology of Dreams, Clinical Studies in Neuropsychoanalysis, and The Brain and the Inner World. His latest book was a bestseller and was translated into 8 languages. He's the editor of the revised standard edition of the complete psychological works of Sigmund Freud, 24 volumes, and the forthcoming complete neuroscientific works of Sigmund Freud. Now, here's the interview. Professor Mark Solms, welcome to Shrink Wrap Radio.
Thank you.
Well, it's good to have you on the show. Some years ago, I was surprised to learn that there's a field called neuropsychoanalysis. And, you know, and I kind of scratched my head. I thought, how can this be? And then more recently, I heard an interview with you by Natasha Mitchell on the Australian podcast All in the Mind, which podcast, sadly, has been discontinued. At any rate, after hearing her interview with you, I realized that you were my go-to guy to learn about neuropsychoanalysis.
That's me.
Okay. Yeah, in the reading that I've done, I think that truly is you. Now, part of the reason for my interest in this topic is that I did my own doctoral work at the University of Michigan many years ago, and at that time, the program was one of the last bastions of psychoanalytic theory in U.S. academia. And, of course, at that time, there was no attempt to relate any of that theory to the brain, which I guess would not be too surprising.
Mm.
Now, probably the best place for us to start is for me to ask, what is neuropsychoanalysis?
It's pretty much what the name suggests. It's an attempt to amalgamate what the neurosciences bring to bear on our understanding of the mind with what psychoanalysis does. It's an attempt to infuse into neuroscience something of the real lived complexity of the life of the mind. And conversely, to introduce into psychoanalysis something of the scientific rigor of the neurosciences. So it's an attempt, I suppose, to get the best of both worlds when it comes to trying to develop a science of the mind proper, rather than a science of those elements or fragments of the mind that lend themselves most easily to experimental approaches.
Well, that's fascinating that it's a two-way street, that not only do you seek to find some verification of at least some of Freud's concepts, but also that you're hoping that that the field of neuropsychology will incorporate some of the psychodynamic insights and hypotheses that might be generated. Now, I understand that you're a psychoanalyst yourself. Was that before or after you decided to establish a stronger connection between psychoanalysis and brain processes?
I'm not sure what sequence you have in mind when you say before or after. I trained, first of all, as a neuropsychologist.
Okay.
That was in the late 70s and early 80s. And I was, like I suspect many of my colleagues, I was frustrated by how narrow was the focus those days of neuropsychology. You know, we looked only at cognitive processes and the like, you know, perceptual and cognitive and language processes. There was very little interest then in emotional and motivational and subjective mental states altogether. So it was out of that frustration that I decided to do what was probably considered by my friends and family a sort of suicidal step, and to train in psychoanalysis. With all of its faults, I thought that at least psychoanalysis does try to embrace all of the difficulties of the actual mind. It's, rather than ruling them out of court because they're so difficult to study, and then behaving as if, you know, the mind is what's left, at least they do try to study it.
Well, that was very courageous of you. You're in South Africa now, and I gather that's where you've grown up and done most of your work in your life. But I believe you went to England to study psychoanalysis. Is that right?
That's correct. That's correct. I was in England for 14 years, and 9 of those 14 years were taken up with my psychoanalytic training.
Uh-huh. And there must have been people on both sides of the fence who are scratching their head. What is this guy up to?
I wasn't as brave as you imagine, because in the early years of my training, I really barely mentioned to anybody in the psychoanalytical institute that I worked in the Department of Neurosurgery the rest of the time, and vice versa. You know, it wasn't very prudent to talk too much about psychoanalysis in an academic department of neurosurgery. But gradually, as I went further and started to do research at the interface between the two fields, you know, then it became more possible to reveal my interest to the two sets of my colleagues.
Oh, yeah, that's fascinating that you were flying beneath the radar, so to speak, and I can totally understand why you'd want to do that. Mm-hmm. Now, I gather your intent is not so much to prove that Freud got all the details right as to explore the extent to which he got the broad strokes. Do I have that right? Can you tell us something about
that?
Yes.
Somebody once, I forget who it was, somebody within the broad area that I'm working, said it's not a matter of proving Freud right or wrong, but rather of finishing the job. And I think that that's what we're doing. You know, Freud, I have absolutely no doubt, would have pursued the lines of inquiry that we are pursuing now. He was a neuroscientist. Freud was for many years deeply involved in neuroscientific research, published many, many, many papers, and even several monographs on neuroscientific topics. And it was very reluctantly that he abandoned those methods to try to understand better how the higher functions of the brain work. It was sort of against his own better judgment that he had to recognize that at that time in the late 19th century, the only way to study the complicated psychological phenomena that he was observing clinically was to use purely psychological methods. There were no neuroscientific methods for studying those things. And, you know, had the methods that we now have available been available to Freud then, I'm sure that he would have made full use of them. So it's in that spirit that I say what we're trying to do is finish the job. You know, Freud was trying to bring the mind into science, trying to, you know, it's part of nature. It must surely be part of, there must be a natural science of the mind. But there were no methods available then for doing and for creating a natural science of the mind. And now those methods are available. So it's a no-brainer, if you'll excuse the pun. That's what we've got to do, use yeah. those methods.
Yeah, I like that, no-brainer. and you know, Freud was seen as a towering figure up until, you know, some years back when, he became a figure for a widespread attack by feminists and academics and other people. And it seems to me that your work may help to restore his stature, because as I hear you describe it right now, it seems to me that he really was a visionary who simply didn't have the tools that we have today. In one of your articles, you quote the Nobel Prize-winning Eric Kandel, who I believe is at Columbia University, as saying of psychoanalysis that it is, quotes, still the most coherent and intellectually satisfying view of the mind, end quote. I don't know if you get the Charlie Rose television interview series there in South Africa, but
we don't have it here, but I do know what you're talking about.
Oh, good. Yeah, Dr. Kandel it's a wonderful interview series. Charlie Rose is just this wonderful interviewer. He would be one of the role models that I would aspire to as an interviewer. And he's done a series with Dr. Kandel, who's been moderating just this wonderful series on the brain with top neuroscientists. I wouldn't be surprised if you get invited to be part of that at some point. And Kandel comes across as both extremely sharp and also very warm. I imagine you've probably met him at conferences or something.
Yes, I know him well.
Yeah. Well, for years when I taught about Freudian theory in undergraduate classes, I went to some pains to persuade students that Freud's id, ego, superego were functional theoretical concepts and not anatomical realities to be found in the brain. But I gather that chapter is being rewritten a bit. Do I have that right?
Yes, you do have it right. You know, if you think about them, Freud's, those two classical concepts, they basically boil down to this. The id is that pole of the mind which represents the demands made by our bodies, our biological embodied existence. You know, that there are, that we have needs and we have desires which necessarily emanate from our, you know, our organismic existence. On the other side, there's the ego, which represents or derives its structure from reality, from the external world, which is where all of our needs have to be met. So although those sound like very metaphorical abstractions, you know, the ego and the id and the reality principle and the pleasure principle and so on, if you think about it, they necessarily must be tethered to the body. The part of the mind that represents the outside world must be tied to the perceptual systems. You know, the perceptual systems of the brain must be tied to the sensory organs of the body. How else can you represent the outside world? And likewise, in the case of the id, you know, the drives, the demands made upon the mind to perform work by dint of its being embodied, those demands can't come from something abstract. You know, they come from our the needs of the bodily economy, which must be concrete things. So starting from those two sort of endpoints, the perceptual organs in the case of the ego, and the homeostatic drives of the body in the case of the id, it goes without saying that somehow these things must have some concrete material existence in brain structure and function.
Yes, and it's hard, you know, as you describe it, it's hard not to imagine what's called the lizard brain or the old brain, you know, as being very much embodying what Freud was talking about as the id, and somehow regions of the cortex sounding very much like the ego and the superego.
Yep. And there again, you know, you remember that Freud was a neuroanatomist and a clinical neurologist. And so when he used these conceptual terms, I'm pretty darn certain that he had in mind in very broad brushstrokes, because that's all that was available to him in terms of knowledge at that time. But I'm pretty certain that he had in mind the very brain systems you've just referred to.
Mm-hmm. And I've heard that Freud uses, in English translation, we see the word instinct used a lot. And I've heard that that's not the best translation of the word that Freud used. And some ways we stumbled over that for a lot of years.
That's correct. The German word that Freud uses is Trieb, T-R-I-E-B, which means nothing more or less than drive. It's simply a mistranslation to put in English the word instinct for the German word Trieb. In fact, in German, there is a word instinct for instinct. You know, you don't even need to know a word of German to realize that instinct means instinct. And Trieb definitely means drive. At the time that Freud was first translated in the late 19th and early 20th century, the word drive wasn't used as widely in academic in scientific circles in English as it is now. So it was sort of slightly I think under the influence of the German word and of the need for us to find an English word that does the same theoretical work as the word Trieb, slowly drive came to be common currency in English, and definitely that's the correct translation.
Mm-hmm. And what about Freud's, I think it's called the topographic system of unconscious, preconscious, and conscious. How does that, in some general way, map to what we know about the brain today?
Well, there are two things to say about that. The first is, we must remember that when Freud introduced the idea that a portion, the majority of the mind, is in fact unconscious, it was thought to be a kind of a nonsense, an oxymoron. How can you speak about unconscious and mind, in the same phrase? And yet now in cognitive neuroscience, the concept of unconscious mental processes absolutely goes without saying. But I'd say in that respect, there's been something of a triumph for Freud, but not very much recognized as that. The idea that a very large portion of our mental life, in fact, operates unconsciously. On the other hand, I think that, and we must remember that Freud himself moved gradually away from that topographical model that you just referred to. You know, Freud initially thought that the major dichotomy in the mind was between the portion that was conscious and the portion that was unconscious. He gradually came to recognize that the part of the mind that represents the outside world and works sort of rationally and is constrained by reality, large portions of that aspect of the mind are themselves unconscious. And this is again what we've rediscovered in cognitive neuroscience, a hell of a lot of perception and memory and volition and decision making and problem solving, and all of that is unconscious, but yet it's perfectly rational and reasonable mental processing. So Freud gradually replaced those concepts with the concepts of ego and id, and of the reality principle and the pleasure principle, replacing this conscious-unconscious distinction. Now, here's where things get tricky, because the id for Freud, as we were discussing a few minutes ago, is that aspect of the mind which represents the drives, the demands that the body makes on the mind. And yet this was also a deeply unconscious part of the mind. In contemporary neuroscience, as we've learned more about the brain mechanisms governing those instinctual and drive homeostatic brain mechanisms that regulate the bodily economy, it turns out that they surprisingly have everything to do with the generation of consciousness, with the generating of feeling states in particular. So it seems as if there was a fairly big there is a fairly big correction needed in relation to Freud's concept of ego and id, in that we have to recognize that large portions of what Freud would have called id are in fact conscious processes.
Hmm. Now, Freud postulated a dynamic unconscious. So while it might be kind of, you know, like a big duh that there are things that go on in terms of regulating our body that we're not consciously aware of, what about the, you know, his idea that some things were not in consciousness, were either repressed, forgotten, whatever, yeah, for motivational reasons? And I think this is an issue that you and your colleagues have kind of struggled with to demonstrate. I think clinically, to me, I think clinically it's obvious, but to prove it in terms of neuroscience, I guess, may be more challenging.
Well, most cognitive neuroscientists say, well, look, yes, Freud was right. There is a large portion of the mind is unconscious, but he was wrong to suggest that it's dynamically unconscious. It's nothing to do with motivation. It's just, you know, non-conscious. And in fact, how could all of your mental processes be conscious? It's an impossibility. You can only have this much, you know, that's in mind at any one point in time. And otherwise, there'd be chaos. But in recent years, there have been some cognitive scientists. Anderson is a good example, who have experimentally demonstrated that motivated forgetting does occur. Not that that's anything like proof of all of the complexities of the dynamic unconscious processes that Freud speaks of. Far more dramatic evidence has come from clinical phenomena in the neurological population. I myself have been particularly involved with the study of a phenomenon known as anosognosia, which means lack of awareness or lack of knowledge of illness. And these are patients who, as the result of damage to a very specific part of the right hemisphere of the brain, they are paralyzed on the left side of their bodies, but insist that they're fine. They believe that they can walk, that they can, you know, do things with both hands, and they patently can't. All evidence points, you know, to the contrary. And so here was an opportunity to study a phenomenon that looks like motivated not knowing in a population of patients where we know what the neurological mechanisms are that produce it. So it's a much more controlled and precise set of variables than, you know, one is used to from the psychoanalytical consulting room. And in fact, it was not me, but rather Ramachandran, now American behavioral neurologist at UCLA, who demonstrated fairly convincingly that this is a motivated state, that these patients are unconsciously aware of their paralysis and that they choose not to know about it. So, in fact, he very amusingly, after I published an article in Scientific American some years back, which touched on this topic, he wrote a letter to the editor in which he said, of course, Freudian mechanisms of repression are at work in anosognosia. The only problem is that the neuroscience community is in denial about it.
Now, he did something clever with a mirror, right?
Maybe
you can explain that setup in brief.
Well, these patients who deny the paralysis on the left-hand side One explanation of it, in fact, probably the most common explanation of it, a non-psychodynamic explanation, is that they are unable to direct their attention to the left-hand side. It's an attentional deficit, sometimes or frequently called neglect. And this is why they're not aware of their illness on that side. It's because they're not aware of anything going on that side. So what Ramachandran did very cleverly, and he's really quite a wizard with these simple little experiments, he used mirrors to reflect the paralyzed left side of the body to the patient's right hemispace. So the patient can see in a mirror on the right that the left side of their body is paralyzed. Now, clearly you can't, if they still deny that the left side is paralyzed, then you can't explain it in terms of lack of attention to the left side, because now the attention is focused on the right side. And what happened instead of them recognizing the paralysis on that side is they started to behave as if the mirror was not a mirror. So even though they know what mirrors are, in every other context, they know that if something is reflected in the mirror on this side, it's coming from that side and so on. As soon as the mirror reflected their own paralyzed left side, they started to behave in entirely illogical and irrational ways in relation to the image. So this was part of the many layers of evidence for the view that this is not a not knowing so much as a not wanting to know.
Okay, very interesting. Now let's talk a little bit about wish fulfillment and the pleasure principle. I think going back to, I think it was maybe Olds, who discovered pleasure centers in the brain years ago, and you sort of linked some of that work to reshape our thinking about the pleasure principle, what Freud called the pleasure principle, which may in fact underlie a lot of learning and so on. Maybe you can take us through that.
That's correct. Where my interest in that system originally discovered by Olds, who called it the self-stimulation system, give a bit of background, he placed an electrode in a part of the brain known as the ventral tegmental area, which is where the source cells are for this dopaminergic pathway. Into the forebrain, and the rats had a choice of either pressing a lever which provided them with food and water, or another lever which gave them stimulation of this system, this ventral tegmental area, and they chose to press the lever that stimulated the ventral tegmental area until they died, at the exclusion of all drinking and eating. So this is clearly a major, major motivational system. It overrides hunger and thirst.
Right.
And this is why it got the name self-stimulation system, because they self-stimulated this system literally to death. But all mammals have that same system, us included. Now, where I came into contact with it was I was studying the effects of damage to different parts of the brain in human beings, effects of damage to different parts of the brain on dreaming. And I found that lesions to this system that I've just mentioned in relation to rats, damage to that part of the brain in humans leads to a cessation of dreaming. And that was a remarkable, for me, it was probably the most fortunate observation that I've made in my entire scientific life.
Let's run it by us again then. So in other words, if that pleasure center is damaged, then dreaming doesn't happen?
For now, let's not use the word pleasure center, because I'll explain that in a moment. But damage to this system, this self-stimulation system discovered by Olds, damage to that system leads to loss of dreaming. And I was initially very skeptical about my observations because, why on earth would damage to this system, which has nothing to do with vision and nothing to do with memory, why should damage there lead to a loss of dreaming? Mm-hmm. But I went back to the earlier psychosurgical literature from the 1950s and thereabouts, and found that exactly the same thing had been described then, when that system was deliberately cut by surgeons in the treatment of psychosis, that these patients by the hundreds described exactly the same thing, that damage to that, severing that pathway led to a loss of dreaming. Now, what that operation also did was lead to a loss of hallucinations and delusions, which is why the operation was done. And if you think about it for a moment, well, that's what dreams are. They're a psychotic state. And I was fairly confident that what I'd observed in my handful of patients, you know, was something robust. This has been described long ago. It's well documented that damage to the system leads to loss of dreams. So now, you know, the question is, what does that system do? And you called it a pleasure system a moment ago.
Yes.
It was originally thought to be a pleasure system because it was so obviously massively motivating to the animal. If you stimulate that system, it really, you know, nothing is more rewarding. But subsequent research in more recent years, in the 1990s in particular, revealed that it's in fact made of two different systems. There's one system which was Berridge at your alma mater, Michigan. Berridge calls it the wanting system, which he differentiates from a second system, which he calls the liking system. The one is an appetite system, the other is a consummation system. Jaak Panksepp calls them the seeking system on the one hand and the lust system on the other. And they have different anatomies and different chemistries. The one is basically a desire system. That's the dopamine system. That's the one that has everything to do with dreaming. And the other is a kind of orgasmic delight system, and that's opioid mediated. It has a different chemistry.
I have to say, they sound like wish fulfillment and pleasure principle.
No, exactly. I mean, you know, this is the beauty of living in the times that we do, is that these things which Freud inferred, abstracted from all of the messy chaos of clinical observation and psychoanalytical observation, you know, came up with these rickety constructs of pleasure principle and wish fulfillment and so on. You know, now we have, as I was saying earlier, these this very precise knowledge of the anatomies and the chemistries of systems in the brain that do exactly these things. But the astonishing thing or the thrilling thing for somebody working in this area like me is to find that Freud makes this absurd, what sounded at the time like a very unlikely claim, you know, that behind every dream there's an attempt to fulfill a wish. And then here I am, you know, 100 years later, finding that the part of the brain that generates the dreams is this wishful, you know, seeking, wanting system. And there's just absolutely no question about it. And it's not only, I mean, I looked at lesions, at damage to that system, but now we've got many different lines of converging evidence. We know from positron emission tomography that system is switched on like a Christmas tree during dreaming sleep. We know from single cell recordings that those cells are firing at a rate second to nothing during dreaming sleep. And we also know from a method called microdialysis, where you literally measure the release of dopamine, that dopamine release is maximal during dreaming sleep. So this system, which motivates all mammals, us included, you know, to the most energized, exploratory, appetitive behavior, this system is switched on full blast during dreams, you know, which seems like a crazy paradox. How can you be so motivated and aroused and energized while you're asleep? And this was exactly, you know, the sort of conclusions that Freud was driven to from studying the psychology of dreams. That he was saying that we are in highly motivated, in fact, disinhibitedly motivated states of desire during sleep. And we dream in order to protect our sleep. Because, you know, if you were to do otherwise, if you didn't have this kind of hallucinatory motivated behavior, you would have to wake up because the id, as he called it, you know, the drives are so unconstrained within the mind during sleep, and this is exactly what we're seeing. So what we're seeing in neuroscience of dreams. So to come back to your original question about wish fulfillment, you know, I think that there is a remarkable degree of convergence between the neurobiological findings of various kinds as regards the brain mechanisms of dreaming and the Freudian hypothesis in broad brushstrokes. But
this is very exciting.
That's why I say that was definitely the most fortunate discovery of my life, and I think it's very unlikely that I'll make another one like that.
Oh boy! Well, you know, you refer to the dream state as psychotic, and there's always the question of, you know, why are dreams so crazy? Why are they so weird? And Freud had two different ideas about that, I think. One was the idea of dream censorship and the idea that some of these wishes were so threatening and forbidden that they had to be disguised. And then I don't know what the temporal order was of these theories, but he also talked about primary versus secondary process thinking, which to me has always seemed like the more sensible way to go at it. So talk to us about those two approaches.
Well, you obviously know your Freud. I'm very impressed. a hell of a lot more about it than many of my psychoanalytical colleagues. That is exactly correct. Freud drew attention to two separate mechanisms for the distorted quality of dream cognition. And I agree with you that I think the major mechanism of the two is the mere fact that you don't think your dream thoughts in words as sort of abstract logico-grammatical constructions, but rather they're regressions from thoughts, from abstract thoughts, to perceptual hallucinatory images, so that things an abstract idea has to be represented concretely. And this literally does have to do, and again, you know, we have now the tools to demonstrate it literally concretely. Now, this has to do with the regression of mental processes from frontal lobes, where abstract and intelligible, verbally mediated programs are formulated, this part of the brain switches off during dreaming sleep, and then the back of the brain, the perceptual parts of the brain are activated. So thoughts are represented visually and spatially as concrete images. This necessarily involves a regression of those thoughts to a more primitive form, and it almost demands some kind of symbolic representation, because the thought can't be given in its original form. It has to be turned into a picture, and the picture stands for the thought. So that I think explains a lot of what needs to be interpreted, to use this frightening word to a scientist. You know, if you have to take the dream images and then turn them back into the thoughts with which they began. But Freud had, as you correctly say, a second idea, that there's also a tendentious aspect to this. Whilst the thing is being converted from a thought into an image, there's also a distorting or camouflaging process that goes on in order to make the consciously dreamed narrative less offensive or less frightening or less alarming to the dreamer. All of this in the service of sleep protection. And there's very little. It's much easier to understand the first of those two processes from the point of view of what we know about the brain mechanisms involved. There's much less evidence for or evidential basis for this censorship aspect of dreams. That's not to say it's not there, but you know, we have to stick to what we know. And I think that the truth is there's less reason to believe that Freud got that bit right.
Yeah, and also there is the problem that that we in fact do have dreams where we experience outrageous things that presumably would be, you know, we dream of incest, we dream of outrageous sexual or aggressive situations yeah. that, you know, should have been repressed. I'm very interested in Jung and his notion that the dream is not attempting to hide or disguise, but really to communicate underlying issues, to restore yeah. a kind of psychic homeostatic balance. Does your work have anything to say about that?
Well, I agree with what you're saying in terms of the transparency of dreams, and that many of the things that we dream about are far from palatable. You know, they're not the sorts of things that we would normally think or do in waking life. And so it does beg the question as to what exactly is this disguise disguising. I think that a good piece of evidence that's relevant to what we're talking about is something called REM behavior disorder in humans. And in animals, there's an equivalent condition where the normal paralysis that characterizes the dreaming phases of sleep, the paralysis is lost, and then the animal or person acts out their dreams. Of course, it all ends in tears, because you can't run around doing things and stay asleep at the same time. And so, you know, we tend to wake up from these enactments. But what's very clear from the study of this condition, both in humans and in other animals, is that what gets enacted are these stereotyped instinctual programs. The cat stalks a mouse and pounces. You know, and the human dreaming gentleman sadly attacks his partner, you know, in bed. Yeah. And so there is very vigorous emotional instinctual actions that are released when the motor paralysis is lost, and you see physically enacted, you know, what kind of motivations lie behind the dream. It all seems fairly transparent and fairly clear cut. Whether this is a matter of working things through is not what I'm not addressing that now. But there is another body of evidence, not neuroscientific evidence, but rather psychological evidence. There's a researcher, Rosalind Cartwright, in Chicago, which is a great university for sleep research. Mm-hmm. And she did some excellent studies showing just that there is a working through of problems during dreams. She studied people getting divorced, and which is a stressful business. And she was able to predict from the dreams, from the sequence of dreams over the night, whether, you know, if the problems, the mental cogitations of the dream resolve themselves over the night from one dream to the other. This predicted that these people were going to manage their divorce without getting depressed. The ones in whom there was not a clear progression in terms of the resolving of the conflicts, the emotional conflicts that were preoccupying them at night, these ones got depressed. And it was a very convincing series of studies in which she was showing that some sort of attempt to resolve things that are stressing or straining us is going on during dreaming.
Oh, that's wonderful. Thanks so much for sharing that. Now, earlier we were talking about the dynamic unconscious, a motivated unconscious, and that raises the whole question of Freud's idea about defense mechanisms and as later elaborated by his daughter, Anna Freud. So what have you been able to find out in relation to the notion of defense mechanisms?
Well, we spoke a little earlier about the condition called anosognosia, in which there is a denial of illness. So that's the one bit of neurological data which speaks to the whole question of defense mechanisms. There's another condition called Korsakoff psychosis or confabulatory amnesia, in which, again, it provides a wonderfully concrete and simple model for studying these sorts of things. So much more experimentally controllable than the neurotic and other psychodynamic phenomena that Freudian theory derived from. We took patients with Korsakoff psychosis or confabulatory amnesia and studied the content of their confabulations. And what became clear was that, well, this is on clinical observation initially, just sitting as a psychoanalyst and talking to these patients. What became clear to the psychoanalytic observer, which no neurologist would ever think about, was that the content of these confabulations appeared to be reconstruing their situations as far more pleasant and far more desirable than their actual state of affairs. Like, for example, the patient would say they're in a hotel rather than that they're in a hospital.
Mm-hmm.
And or that they're at home rather than that they're in some strange place. And so having made that clinical observation, we then took all the confabulations and gave them to blind raters to rate whether the confabulation versus the real state of affairs made things more pleasant for the patient or less pleasant for the patient on a Likert scale. And that was very significant. Initially, just in a single case study, and then we did group studies, that the confabulations distorted the reality of the patient in a wishful direction. So there again, there's some sort of defensive process going on, which protects the patient from an awareness of their actual situation, which can be related to a specific brain mechanism and can be measured and demonstrated in a replicable fashion. So the fact that there is evidence for there being defensive processes, I think, is very strong. We don't yet have much beyond that, beyond the demonstrate sort of proof of concept, as they say. We don't know what it is that goes on that differentiates, say, for example, an intellectualization from a rationalization, from a projection, from splitting, etc. But the very idea that there are defensive processes motivated, mediated by emotional states, I think is fairly unassailable.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. What do we learn from comparative animal studies that helps to shed light on these issues? And I know that's a big question, but maybe you can comment on it.
It is a big question, and it's also a very controversial question, because of course there are all sorts of ethical problems that arise with animal research. But the basic facts are that in experimental work, one wants to be able to manipulate the causal variables. You don't want to just observe correlations. You need to be able to alter the causal variable and see whether the predicted effect occurs or not.
Yes.
And as much as the ethical questions in regard to animal research are, I think, very valid questions, nevertheless, the reality is that you're able to do those kinds of manipulations in animals still today far more readily than you can with humans. And there's just no question from an ethical point of view of manipulating the relevant brain mechanisms in humans in the way that we still can with animals. So the main reason why animal research is done is this. And if you go back to what we were talking about in regard to, for example, the drives, the instinctual drives, whereby the demands of the body are represented in and motivating new brain mechanisms, in the case of animal research, you can literally directly manipulate these relationships. You can see what happens. You manipulate hunger, you manipulate thirst, you chemically increase or decrease the hypothalamic mechanisms in question, and then you see the effects. And to be able to do that sort of thing with human subjective states is so much more kind of fleeting and fugitive and so much more difficult to pin down and control. So it's obvious that you want to rather be able to turn to animals to be able to understand better what the causal mechanisms at that end of the, you know, of the mental apparatus are. The downside of doing animal research, apart again, as I keep saying, from the ethical concerns, is that, of course, animals can't talk to us.
Right.
So we have no direct access to the subjective experience of animals, and we have to infer their experience from their behavior. So I think that, you know, it's actually quite simple. The way forwards is that one must do both. You know, there are things that you can do with humans where you have access to their subjective experience, at least in the form of verbal reports. But you can't do the manipulations of the brain structures that you want to. And in animals, you do have the more direct manipulation of the causal brain variables, but you don't have the subjective states. And to use both sets of data, and you know, if when you manipulate a structure in an animal and it behaves in a way that looks, for example, fearful, and then, you know, in a human being who has a seizure in the focus in the same structure, and they tell you that when they have their seizures, they feel terrified, you know, then you have fairly good reason to believe, well, this structure is doing the same thing in both, and when the animal looks terrified, it probably feels terrified. So we use this approach of trying to find converging lines of evidence between animal studies and human studies.
And as a result of this kind of continuity, I gather that that you have come to assume that other mammals have minds. Is that right?
I'm sorry, Dave. No, I am. You are breaking up, and that last sentence I didn't hear. Can you repeat that?
Yeah, I gather that that you are assuming that other mammals have minds. We're not.
Yes, well, that's a good case in point of the general principle that I was enunciating a moment ago. You know, in human beings, we know, for example, that the periaqueductal gray, which is a region of the upper brainstem, when that structure is lesioned, is damaged, we lose consciousness completely. When you stimulate the frontal bits of it, you feel orgasmic delight. When you stimulate the back half of it, you feel excruciating pain and terror. Now, with animals, they have exactly the same structure. It's built in the same columnar fashion. It's connected in the same way. And when we damage that structure in animals that have it, that is to say, in this case, all mammals, they lose consciousness. You see it. You know, they behave exactly like a human being would who's gone into a coma. You stimulate the front part of it, they're your best friend forever. You stimulate the back part of it, they want nothing more to do with you. So there's every reason to believe, on the basis of these homologs, you know, that the structure looks the same, has the same chemistry, has the same connectivity, the behaviors that it elicits are the same as in humans. The only thing that we can't get from the animals is them saying what it feels like and saying, yes, I'm conscious, you know, this is, you know, hello, here I am. But all of the evidence points to the fact that this structure is doing the same thing in other animals. And so I would rather pose the question, rather than saying, you know, how do we know animals, the animals with these structures like ours, how do we know that they have minds? I think it's more the other way around. What on earth would make you think they don't have minds? Because, you know, if they have the same structure that does the same thing physiologically and chemically as we do, and we know in our cases this is the thing that generates the consciousness, what is the evidence for the view that it's not doing the same thing in other animals?
Yeah, I think anybody who's ever owned a good dog knows that animals have minds. And for years, psychology just leaned over backwards, you know, warning against anthropomorphization. And so, you know, a lot of the people who listen to this show are either therapists themselves or in school planning to be therapists. Are there any practical implications for psychotherapeutic treatment that come out of neuropsychoanalytic theory?
There are. I would say, first of all, in the most general sense, if I can answer that question in two ways. In the most general sense, everything that we do as psychotherapists is ultimately based upon a theory of how the mind works. You know, the everything we do would make no sense unless it was rooted in some conceptualization of what's the matter in for example, an obsessive compulsive disorder. You're treating it, you have some idea of what it is that you're trying to alter, and that in turn is rooted in some theory of how, you know, of how the whole thing works. If you're, to the extent that your theory of how the mind works and your theory of the mechanism of OCD is wrong, to that extent your therapy is going to be hampered. You know, it just sort of goes without saying. Mm-hmm. So even if it's not immediately apparent, when we're doing pure research in trying to understand better from a neuroscientific point of view, you know, bringing neuroscientific methods to bear on psychoanalytical theories and on the sort of phenomena that used to be the stomping ground only of psychoanalysis and clinical psychotherapies. If this leads us to a better understanding of how the thing works, it must eventually somehow lead to better therapies, even if it's not immediately clear how it's going to do that. So that's a sort of a starting point. But we've been at this now for long enough to have begun to start making observations of that kind. And so, you know, we are beginning to see clinical relevance from the basic research that we're doing. And if I can mention one or two examples, one obvious one is the famous repression. You know, what we now know about the mechanisms of certain forms of repression, for example, the failure to remember a traumatic incident. Freud's view was that the incident being extremely unpleasurable causes motivated forgetting, that one avoids the memory of the very unpleasant experience, and this is what repression is all about. We now know that the actual mechanism of forgetting in traumatic amnesias has to do with the release of these stress hormones, corticosteroids, which literally prevent the hippocampus from laying down the memory in the first place. So there is no episodic memory. There is no encoded experience of the traumatic event. So you can't retrieve it. You can't bring it back to mind. It never was laid down in the first place. So you can see where I'm heading. You know, the clinical technique of trying to recover a memory of a traumatic moment that never was encoded in the first place is a futile technique. That's not to say that there aren't other situations in which an episode is forgotten in this motivated way, but there are cases in which the mechanism of the forgetting is a failure to encode in the first place. And probably the biggest example of that is the famous infantile amnesia. In the first 2 years of our lives, we do not have functional hippocampi. We cannot lay down episodic memories. It's not possible to remember your own birth. You know, no matter how hard you try, no matter how many primal screams you release, you will never remember your own birth because the brain mechanisms by which episodic memories are encoded simply weren't there. So, you know, these are the sorts of, I mean, I'm giving just two examples out of several possibilities, which just to prove the point or to illustrate the general principle that out of understanding better the brain mechanisms of our mental processes, alterations in our therapeutic techniques definitely will ensue.
You close a recent article from earlier this year with the following statement, quotes, "In sum, neuropsychoanalysis uses the best approaches of standard brain research, but does not prevaricate about the causal role of mental processes in the functions of neural networks. Now, prevaricate leapt out at me as a strong word. Who is it that's been lying or evasive, and about what?
Well, that's an article in a journal called TICS, Trends in Cognitive Science. And we're speaking there, my co-author and I are speaking there mainly to our neuroscientific colleagues who do exactly that, prevaricate about two things. About, first of all, whether or not animals have minds, which is a topic that we've just been discussing. There's a long shadow of behaviorism over animal neuroscience, you know, and there's just no two ways about it. Behaviorism didn't die; it sort of morphed into behavioral neuroscience. Mm-hmm. And many of the leading animal neuroscientists really still have a big problem with the idea of mental states, and they want to study behaviors only. And in animals, you can't speak about their mental states. It's much easier to speak only of behaviors and make no reference to subjective states. So it's partly speaking to the issue of, you know, come on, you know, don't tell me dolphins and dogs and whales and elephants and so on have no mental states. You know, let's talk about it. Let's admit it. They do. And why that's important leads to the second issue, which is that if you treat the brain as if it were just like any other bodily organ, you know, as if it were the same as the heart or the pelvis or the lung, you know, you're missing something very, very basic about how the brain works, which distinguishes it from those organs. The brain, unlike any other bodily organ, is capable of consciousness. It feels like something to be a brain. And brains have, out of this subjectivity, they have other remarkable properties like volition and agency and free will. And these things exist. You know, they exist in nature because of something about how brains work. And if we're not going to be allowed to talk about these things in the neuroscience of behavior and mental processes, then we are doing great violence to the actual nature of this part of nature that we're studying. And so what we're saying there in that article is, you know, we need to be clear that mental phenomena exist. They are part of this remarkable organ called the brain, and they have causal efficacy. You know, to feel something changes the way that the brain behaves. It's not an epiphenomenon. These are not just sort of nice-to-haves that you can leave out of your science. You know, you just think about somebody who kills themselves, you know, because they can't bear the pain anymore. Don't tell me that the pain doesn't do something, you know. The pain has the most obvious concrete consequences in the material world, so much so that the person brings their very life to an end. And what we are saying in that article is that we need to bring this center stage in neuroscience. We have to stop prevaricating about the fact that the brain is different from the liver. You know, the brain has feelings, and feelings have causal effects on behavior. That's sort of the nub of the matter.
Well, that's a good, strong statement for us to close on. I've already held you longer than I said I would, but it's just been such a fascinating conversation that it's hard not to, and I'm sure we could talk more, but I will let you go. So,
thank you. Thank you. I've enjoyed it. I've enjoyed it enormously. And for me, I agree with you. This field is absolutely fascinating. I can't imagine why anybody wants to do anything else.
Right. Well, Professor Mark Solms, thanks for being my guest today on Shrink Wrap Radio.
Thank you very much indeed. I've enjoyed it.
I hope you got as much of a kick out of this interview as I did. I think it's one of my all-time favorites. I'm probably influenced by the pretty compliment Mark paid me, saying something to the effect that my command of psychoanalytic theory was better than that of many psychoanalysts he knows, and this from someone who's translating the works of Freud. Well, needless to say, that made my day. And I thought we had great rapport, and he expressed both during the recording and after the mic was off how much he enjoyed the interview. There is so much more that we could have covered. I skipped over a few of my questions, but we definitely got to all the really important stuff, I think. I was going to introduce into the discussion a couple of quotes from his articles that I was particularly struck by, and I did introduce a couple, and here are a couple that didn't get in, and I'll share them with you now. Here's one. There is much in neuropsychoanalysis that is old, much that is borrowed, but also some perspectives that are new. Perhaps foremost, it seeks to understand the human mind from a cross-species evolutionary perspective, hopefully illuminating the affective roots of human nature more than traditional approaches have so far. And this next one is also relevant to our discussion on comparative research with animals. He writes, quotes, "A key aspiration is to develop neuropsychologically and neurochemically based therapies for psychiatric disorders grounded in cross-species understandings of emotional experiences," end quote. By the way, I would like to dedicate this episode to listener and friend Paul Moore. Paul attended a workshop I conducted in Ireland 6 or 7 years ago. At that time, he was studying psychoanalysis at Trinity College, and now he is a psychoanalyst. It was from Paul that I first heard the term neuropsychoanalysis. Paul was also my guest on Shrink Wrap Radio number 234 on psychoanalysis in Ireland. Paul, I sure hope you're listening. Those recorded promos I've been playing don't seem to be working so well. It's been some time since we've received any new donations. I know it's a tough economy out there, and I also know that I'm still working for about $10 an hour to bring you top-quality education and entertainment. I'm getting lots of new signups on our email list, so how about joining the others who have helped to support this show and add your own vote with your wallet? And thanks in advance. Don't forget, this Sunday morning, August 5th at 10 a.m. Pacific, I'm trying a new experiment of offering a free DreamWorks group on Google Plus Hangouts. I can only let in the first 9 people who show up. If you decide to join us, be sure to bring the most recent dream you can recall and to have written it out on a word processor so that we can all see it, maybe. Write it in the present tense, give it a title, and make sure it's no longer than a paragraph or two. If you're not already following us on Google+, you'll find instructions under the Contact Us tab at shrinkwrapradio.com. And speaking of dreams, there's still space in my 2-day workshop on dreams in Stockholm, Sweden, on Saturday and Sunday, September 8 and 9. You can find full details on the site. Just click on the Swedish flag icon in the right-hand sidebar on the site, and that will give you all the information you need to sign up. We've now got more than 60 continuing education units that you can earn by just listening to these podcasts, and there's more on the way. In fact, I'll probably be announcing a new course on the very next show, or maybe the one after that. Thanks to the help of a volunteer, we do have a new transcript on the site for Shrink Wrap Radio number 254, A Psychiatrist's Most Bizarre Cases with Gary Small, MD. Be sure to let me know if you'd like to help support the show by being a transcriber.
Hi, my name is Judy from County Cork, and you're on the couch with Dr. Dave.
Thanks, Judy in County Cork. Since I'm running long, I'll just read one email, and it's from Tony, who writes, "I'm a new listener, and already I'm hooked." Great. "I cherish the insights of yours and your guests, and I admire your affable yet probing interview style. It's good to question people's assertions and to see their reactions. So far, I have particularly enjoyed episodes about dreams, sleep, the unconscious. I even went so far as to try Jerry Trumbull's recliner, Lucid Dreaming. I spent 30 minutes, and as far as I got was some heavy body sedation, but no visuals. Maybe I wasn't dream-deprived enough, but I have a feeling once I get there, I will just fall asleep. Thanks for the podcast. And again, that's from Tony. Tony, I'm so happy to welcome you as a new listener to Shrink Wrap Radio. You've got a lot of catching up to do. There are a lot of good episodes. And speaking of the one by Jerry Trumbull that you mentioned, you know, he later revised some of his thoughts about that. So be sure to listen to the follow-ups to that particular interview. Doesn't necessarily mean that you should stop doing what you're doing, but he does give some cautions. So I'm going to wrap it up with that. And I'm going to assume that you know how to contact me by now, so I'll skip all that info. Thanks to today's guest, Professor Mark Solms, for bringing us up to date on the exciting field of neuropsychoanalysis. And my next interview will most likely continue the focus on body work with my longtime colleague, Dr. Eleanor Criswell, who, among her many activities, edits the journal Somatics. So until then, this is Dr. Dave saying, it's all in your mind.
You've been shrink-wrapped by Dr. Dave. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make you dangerous.